This is the Music Buzz Podcast. Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz Podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy. How are you doing today?
I'm good. And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hello, Andrew.
Today on the Music Buzz Podcast, we are proud to welcome Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, musician and songwriter Ross Valerie, regarded as one of the best bass guitarists and an original member of multi-platinum band Journey until his 2020 departure. Ross's debut solo record is called All of the Above. We're going to get into that today. And welcome to the Music Buzz, Ross. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's quite comfortable and exciting to be here. It really is. And 9 out of 10 doctors recommend All of the Above. Do it all. Listen to it all.
Well, you haven't been on this podcast. You're not going to want to hear all this, our crap. I'm just kidding. The two tracks I've got to hear, Wild Kingdom. Wow. So it's kind of like the first thing I got was like a updated kind of a weather report, you know, Birdland kind of feel, which that's not bad since that was probably one of the biggest jazz fusion songs of all time. Not that it really sounds like, but just it brought that to mind a little bit. It was like, wow, this is really cool. I haven't heard anything quite like this before. Tell me about it, writing that, and tell me how you came up with that.
Well, I will tell you all about it, and thank you for the compliment. In retrospect, after the song developed with all the other instrumentation and the arrangement, it came to my mind, as no surprise, there is a slight weather report influence there. And I am certainly influenced by them. And as it is with all of my material, you can't say, well, that's just that kind of stuff or it's that style. There's nothing particularly pure. It's a fusion of all the influences that I've had musically since I was a child. And what goes in comes out as impressionism. But the beginning of Wild Kingdom was in the mid-80s when I was experimenting with a DX7 and found this calliope patch, you know, the stuff you hear at the merry-go-round or at the circus. I thought this was cool. And then I started messing around with black keys only, and which is, for you musos, if you play only black keys, you get a 5-tone scale instead of 8. It's a pentatonic. I did fudge. I did cheat a little bit. There are some white keys in there, but the melodies, all the themes that loop and grow throughout the song are pentatonic. So it's something I wrote alone in the mid-80s, and I jammed it with a few people who would come into an artist workshop kind of environment. And I was fortunate to be on tour with Journey in Central America with Santana. And on the day off, before we had a day off before we all flew home, and I'm sitting there having coffee in the courtyard of the hotel, and Carl Perazzo, master percussionist with Santana, the guy that I watch always when I watch Santana, walks by with a pair of new high-top sneakers that have been custom painted by a famous Mexican artist. And he sits down, admires his shoes, and I say, hey, you know, I got this song idea, and I started just tapping on the tabletop. He goes, I got it. I'm going, what do you mean? He's going, okay, what are you doing next week? So within actually, for real, within a couple of weeks, he'd come into my studio and brought Wally Reyes Jr.
Oh, yeah.
Alfredo de los Reyes Jr., who is also a former Santana drummer, and they banged out these tracks. But what I had done before he and Wally came in is I demoed an arrangement of this song, which can always be different. It's like Changeable Charlie. So what came out as an arrangement is what you hear. I did that on the Calliope with Eric Levy, my main cohort keyboard player. He did it on the Rhodes. And we banged out an arrangement to a click. And then Wally and Carl came in and banged it out in like less than a take. Moved the click, and it hasn't been there since. And we built the song, brought in Mark Russo on two occasions early on after those basics were done. And then later on when I moved studios, I did the bass last, basically, because I've been playing the song on the keyboard forever. It's like I didn't even think about the bass, and it naturally, I'd like to think naturally, it fell out well. There's one other ad about this arrangement. It's co-written with Eric Levy. He appears on all my music, and he's part of my three-man production team. Eric comes from an eccentric band called Garage Mahal, but he's probably known as that
great name,
the Glues to Night Ranger, for decades now. You know, this song could really use an intro. And so what he did is he created an intro in the relative minor key. The key of the song is in F sharp. He did it in E flat minor, I believe. And I said, so cool. Let's make an instrumental bridge out of that. And that's where the solos appear. So that's the story. And that.
Do you tend to write on keys always yourself?
Well, there are several songs I've written on keyboards, including one that appeared in the first Journey album, Conversations. Conversations is it's bookended to the end of In My Lonely Feeling, but it's that's done on piano.
That was your song also, In My Lonely Feeling, right?
Contributed to it, but mostly it's Conversations, yeah. Which was originally Conversations with a Brick Wall. But and there's another song I did on the Journey soundtrack for the Japanese film, and that appears on an album called Dream After Dream. It's an import, but you can get it digitally. I wrote some other stuff on piano, and there are other songs in the hopper because I'm not done yet.
I couldn't find Dream After Dream, but I read somewhere about Snow Theme. Is that one of the things
Snow
that
theme.
You did?
Yeah, the band was just really fortunate to be invited by CBS Sony to go to Japan to the Sony studios there and provide a soundtrack for a film that was written based on an ancient Japanese myth, but it was written and directed by Italians. It was acted by French people. It was filmed in Spain and then distributed by Toho. Anyhow, nothing. It was just a wonderful experience because it's similar to early Journey, the Dream After Dream soundtrack is. And that's what comes to mind with my music. It's not necessarily targeted to popular music or trends. It's creativity, sure. And in my case, a fusion of lots of influences. There is, Wild Kingdom is a song which I wrote and performed on keyboards. There is another song which people will see a video, a YouTube video for and hear it streaming within a month. It's called Windmill, which I wrote on guitar and recorded on guitars. And like I said, there are many other songs written from piano that will eventually come out and some more guitar work. But a lot of things I've written on bass. So it might be obvious by the way you hear them. Tomland was my first video and streaming release from mid-January.
That's more of a kind of a jam band, you know, I want to say a heavy Grateful Dead-ish kind of a vibe or something. It's great, but totally different than Wild Kingdom. That's what I liked about it. It was like, oh man, cool. You know,
there's several things to say here. One is Tomland was written really as a standalone bass thing, and I played it a lot under different circumstances. I would play it alone at the sound check, and sometimes I would jam with people. In fact, I'm sure it was jammed at a Journey sound check, but over the years, it's been around as a composition, a complete composition since the 70s.
You could feel this was a bass player's song, though, as it starts. There's a predominant, there's a lovely presence of the bass at the beginning.
Thank you. And actually, it is a standalone because I'm playing three-note chords through half of it. So it's sort of like this big, fat rhythm guitar thing. I think some music critic said almost kind of like, I don't know, Duane Eddy or something. I don't know. So the other thing about the material overall, especially with the vast difference between Tomland and Wild Kingdom, is that my genre is no genre. So you can hear that on Tomland that I recorded with Prairie Prince and Miles Sean and Eric Levy is a completely different song than Wild Kingdom.
Yeah.
So it will be with every other song that you'll either hear released on its own or that which you will hear on the album. And hence the title, All of the Above. And
there's my favorite albums are like that. They don't feel like they're a genre, you know?
Well, wish me luck.
So that's cool that you had Prairie Prince involved, who was like the original guy to did the demos for the first Journey record, right? That he'd been around back in those days. And so you guys are still buds.
For years. I can expand upon that for another minute or two, if you like.
Please do. Yeah,
please do.
And he was with the Tubes way back in the very beginning. And he was brought into the project, the Journey project, as it were, and did record the first complete demo, most of which became the first album re-recorded for CBS. He did the first performances that Journey did. Winterland, New Year's Eve with Bill Graham, and then New Year's Day in the crater in Hawaii. That was 374. Anyhow, Prairie and I have worked a lot over the years. He and I recorded as I directed the recording for the Cyclops Blues Band. He invited me to join him and some other fine musicians to do an album with and a short Scandinavian tour with a Swedish rock star, Klas Engström. And then he also brought me in at the last moment to do Todd Rundgren's Second Wind live recording project.
Nice.
Awesome. It just only lasted 3 weeks, but it was such a concentrated, incredibly creative, beautiful experience. But Prairie and I have worked a lot. If people haven't heard Second Wind, I think it's one of Todd's best albums, and you can find it. I'm very proud of it. It was like, what just happened? I mean,
what year was that?
91. Yeah. You know, I'm so proud of that. And it's just, again, Todd's situation, as it was with Steve Miller when I was with him, the second album was a throwaway. He was ending his relationship with the record label, but he was obligated to do one more album. So it was like, okay, I'll give you an album. And it was definitely all over the place. And I mean, in a beautiful way. He brought material in that he had written for a Broadway musical. He did all kinds of stuff. And I think it was amazing, just amazing. So back to Prairie Prince. We've continued to work. And in this case, Prairie has done all of the album artwork and other things for that which one will see currently as a little thumbnail, but it looks like I might put out a CD, and the layout design for all of it is complete. And Prairie also did the title cards. The first thing you see for the Timeland in Wild Kingdom video, that's his artwork, his lettering. And probably a good segue here is, who did the video? Well, his longtime friend and partner and co-conspirator in creating the imagery for the tubes, Michael Cotton. He's doing the video work. So,
was that AI? AI was involved in that.
AI is involved as a tool. He calls it grading. He looks for sources. He looks for something to work with, but he actually manipulates it. A lot of this AI stuff is you feed some input and you push the button. Thank you very much. No, he actually goes in and manipulates and changes and selects.
You can see that.
I think that's, from what I've seen out there, I think what Michael Cotton does is completely new thinking. It's an original approach. I haven't seen other people do that.
The video is really good. I liked it.
You clearly don't mind heights.
and the beautiful thing about that is Michael, you know, I'm acquainted with him from years ago at the tubes. So we have been hanging out, but the guy is so intuitive, and it helps when people involved with producing some aspect of your music likes it. He really likes it, and so he can see it. It's taken very little input from me, very little tweaking, so to speak.
The suede shoes were cool too.
Yeah, you know, it almost looks like some shoes I have. Anyhow, the desert scene, that was his idea. I said, some of the country wandering along a road, and then when the heavier parts of Timeland come in, maybe there's a storm. There's the storm again.
You know, oh, there it is.
I know.
He just ran with it. He flew me in the air, and it's like, okay. And relating to the video for Wild Kingdom, what I said to him, I said, this song is very linear. There are themes that loop and get bigger, but it's like a driving, like a fast car going down a straight highway in the desert, or a train just move along. And that's basically all the input I gave him, and the rest is just his intuitiveness and representing the music. It makes me look like a genius, but you know, I'm just fortunate to have people like him and Prairie who can interpret with some input, interpret the music so well.
No, they did great work.
Fantastic.
Were you drawn to bass first, or were you a guitarist before, or pianist?
As a child, young child, I was singing with my mother and my family, and she introduced me to piano and ukulele.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, one of my older brothers, who's also musical, acquired a classical guitar, you know, a Spanish guitar, and I started strumming on that. But I really, my beginnings of music were very eclectic, because the family listened to all kinds of things all the time. Singing in the church, singing in school choirs as a child, but I finally got to join the school band when I was in third grade. And according to my mom, I actually wanted to play the drums, but the positions were full. But the director knew I was musical, so he needed clarinet players. So I played that all the way through high school in a school district that was really good at providing good direction, good instruments, good music. But I moved up to bass clarinet because I wouldn't have to audition for parts couple of months.
Exactly. Where was the school at? Where did you grow up at? What town was it?
It was the Ocalani School District in Lafayette, California, which is the East Bay. But I was just really fortunate to be in a good system. And one third of the kids were in performing arts. It's like, wow. Mm-hmm. That's my tax money for the good stuff. In any event, someone walked up to me that just moved into town when I was a sophomore in 1965. And he said, hey, I know you play bass clarinet, you play guitar at home. It's like he'd done this research. He goes, I'm starting a rock and roll band with some of your friends. Why don't you get your mom to go down to the local store and rent a bass and an amp? I'll show you the parts. It's easy. We'll have fun and make some change. From listening to Dave Brubeck in the afternoon to, for your listening enjoyment, Louie.
Bop, bop, bop. Pop up. Come on.
Land of a Thousand Dances. It was a white soul band. We did stuff like Mitch Ryder and Paul Revere, but we also did James Brown. But we did not bother to mess with something as sophisticated as the Beatles. Mm. Other bands slaughtered them. We did surf, white soul, black soul, and had a lot of fun. So I made somewhat of a sidebar there in my sophomore year in high school.
So after high school, what was next for you at that time?
Well, I was doing college prep courses. That was okay. Set up in high school, college prep for medicine or science.
Oh, really? Okay.
Really?
At the time, the language of science was not English, so I chose German or French. I chose German. But anyhow, with this advent of rock and roll, by the time I had graduated from high school, after continuing with the symphonic band and the a cappella choirs and all that, I went to the local junior college and lasted about a semester and a half there. And hence, various members of little high school groups gathered together to form the second generation of Frumious Bandersnatch, which was just in time for the San Francisco music scene in the late 60s. And we were fans of Steve Miller, eventually got to perform opening for him. And when Frumious dispersed, some of the members joined the Steve Miller Band, and that's where I was brought in as the bassist. And I did one album with him called Rock Love. It's lesser known because it's before he reinvented himself from the Steve Miller Blues Band to Steve Miller Band. It's called Love. And again, it was a throwaway. He was done with Mercury Records. And so, but throwaway records are always very inventive because you are not worried. And there's some good stuff on Rock Love. Yeah, it's pretty experimental.
So those years between, it looks like that Rock Love came out in 71, the first Journey record, 75. So 72, 73, 74, leading into Journey, what were you up to?
Well, actually, Journey formed in the summer of 72, even though
it didn't. Wow. Okay. So you guys were together for a while before. I didn't realize
I had left Frumious Bandersnatch to join a band because there was this other musician that I hadn't worked with, but knew well and played on creatively on the side with George Tickner. He was one of the founding members of Journey as a very, very brilliant writer and an inventive guitarist. And so I was working with him on some projects in the area, in the Bay Area, but not performing per se, just being creative and recording ideas. But Journey formed when Herbie Herbert brought Neil Sean and Greg Raleigh, who had retired from Santana, and I retired from Steve Miller. He brought the three of us and George Tickner and Prairie Prince together to form what he thought of the idea at the time would be a great idea. It'd be like the local Wrecking Crew, a band of players that provide anything for any artist or songwriter that was then coming to San Francisco a lot to write and record. It quickly developed into what became Journey. And as I said earlier, we recorded a complete demo with an old friend of mine and fellow alumni, Steve Jarvis. And that's the album that Prairie Prince recorded on. And then he could not stay with the Journey as it was because he was still committed to the Tubes as now the only drummer in the Tubes and still had an art career to pursue. So that's when we went on a search and found Ainsley Dunbar, who had just finished working with Frank Zappa. And then we got the record deal and recorded in 74 and released in 75. So the release date 75, the Journey began 3 years before that and was outperforming before the release.
Are those original demos available with Prairie playing those tunes?
I'd love to hear those. And you know, when you wonder about copywriting and who owns the man I have no idea, but there's some good stuff. There's a couple of songs that didn't go on the album, which, oh man, there's so much material to remember.
That'd be cool to hear that stuff though. And, you know, yeah, just to hear a different version of those songs.
Yeah.
I love those early records. Those are awesome. Obviously, people know all the popular songs, but those early records are awesome.
Well, thank you, Andy. And the correlation for all of the above and what I'm doing now, it's reminiscent of how experimental Journey was in the beginning. We were not looking at what the trends were necessarily, or popular music. We were just playing and capturing it. And it was a different band with a completely different musical approach, which I think is similar to what I'm doing now. So my songwriting was more prominent in the very beginning when it was more instrumentally oriented and it was experimental. And so all this material that has been stacking up on my desk, so to speak, for decades is coming to light. And I'm not looking at carving out a piece of the music industry, whatever that is. Okay. I'm making this at this point, and I'm just hoping that people will have a chance to know about it and to be able to hear it. And then I guess in this case, be able to see it as well. So
how far back in your archives, are these compositions coming from?
Tom Land, 1970 or so.
Oh, wow.
Wild Kingdom, 1984, 85.
Okay.
Windmill, the beginnings of it. Windmill, if people are not familiar, is an up-tempo Latinesque Brazilian feel and with intricate sections and a clear melody, but it was written actually on an acoustic guitar in a 6/8 style, flowing romantic piece. That was done, the first version of that, I've written it pretty well complete in the early 70s as well.
Okay.
Huh.
It's about awesome, time to get these things out. Come on now.
By the time I had finished my favorite version of Incident at Nishabur, which had been on my list, I'd love to cover that. By the time I did that in 2018 or so, I looked at the boys. It was pretty much a live basic except for saxophone. And I looked around at the boys. I said, this is it. I've succeeded. And they said, what do you mean? I said, I've succeeded in doing what I set out to do. This is beautiful. And as I was saying earlier, there are different musicians for different songs on the album as they're best suited. And to have all these players come in and like what they're doing, besides just being session players, and for me to have completed all these things, that, to me, that's success. It would be nice if the world gets to hear it. We shall see.
So I'm going to dial back on a few things. We talked about artwork for the new record.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the direct correlation here between Hugh having done some artwork for one of the bands you were in, called The Storm. So if we could talk about that a little bit, that'd be great.
Yeah, we should, because there's a good anecdote here. Hugh and I, before we started recording, did confirm that we have never met, but actually, this is really cool. Hugh's artwork for the first Storm album on Interscope is a full frame picture of a little dainty British guy with wire rimmed glasses, a full suit, a tie, a bowler hat, and an umbrella. He's standing knee high in the ocean while there's a storm up above. There was an immediate rumor among the fans that that was me.
That's good.
So I jumped on it. I lied. Yes, that's me. And I'm the guy. Right.
That makes sense. That makes sense because I wanted the guy to look like Jerry Van Dyke. So there you are.
Exactly. So in a parallel universe, if that was me, we did meet and hang out, right?
Yeah. Well, you may find this interesting or not. That whole session was done. We created a 2x12 board frame and filled it with black, very impervious vinyl and sandbagged the whole frame and filled the studio with water. So that was all done in the, yeah, it was all done in the studio, as was the Volkswagen, the top of the Volkswagen from the other part of the album. So yeah, this whole thing, plus a big MGM backdrop of the stormscape was also set behind that frame. And then, of course, some retouching. I had a dye transfer print made and did all the retouching so it didn't feel quite so obvious that it was in the studio. But yeah, it was all done very, very analog, pre-digital. It's the way we solved that problem.
And what, may I ask, in complete ignorance, are you still doing album art? Are you still doing
this? Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm going to have to Google you. Googly woogly.
Google, man. Yeah, no, I have persistent clients, who gratefully are still part of my life. And then I get absolutely new people sort of emerging, from anywhere, from the Czech Republic, from Rio de Janeiro, people that just find you, have liked your work for years. And then Kevin Shirley surfaced recently, and he's been very busy with a lot of artists that
I would love to find Kevin Shirley. Maybe you can hook
I can up. Set that up, yeah.
What a fantastic producer. And
a great guy, too. I mean, out of nowhere, he approached me 4 years ago to work with Joe Bonamassa. And
oh, man. Well, I would love to get a hold of him.
Yeah, he's got great ears, that boy.
Yeah, Hugh just did that. If you look up the new Black Country Communion record, they just released the first single yesterday, I think. It's right. Glenn Hughes, Jason Bonham, Joe Bonamassa, and Derek Serenian's in the band.
Glenn Hughes.
Whoa. Yeah.
That has to be good.
Yeah, listen to the first single they just put out. But Hugh did the artwork for that project.
Yeah. Well, there's pretty interesting cool. anecdotes about the storm, come to think of it. We were the first band to sign with the Interscope, with the Jimmy Iovine and folks,
yep.
and produced what I think is a really, really good record.
Yep, it is. 1990,
91. And we went on a tour, a complete tour opening for Bryan Adams, U.S., and I think some Canada. And did well on that. And we came back and recorded the second album, which is called Eye of the Storm. And we brought it to Jimmy Iovine. He goes, this is brilliant. This is better than the first one. Why, thank you. But he goes, however, we no longer have a promotion department for this kind of music.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And what they had been doing in the meantime was signing Color House and Primus and other bands like that, in which they could
Neverland
for veteran artists, and they could probably own a piece of the publishing so that they could throw the dice. And if the spaghetti didn't stick to the wall, they wouldn't suffer the loss. So we walked away with the album, and it kind of, the second album, it floated around, but it's indicative. Of what was going on at the time. There was a very large audience of people who liked that kind of music and even liked Journey's music. And there was a market for the labels to continue providing that kind of music, but nobody wanted to sell it. All the record guys were looking over their shoulder. Oh, I really like this stuff, and I know I could sell it, but we don't do that now.
Well, grunge came in, right? That whole thing.
It was an economic choice of a smaller bet and a better odds for the.
Was that band kind of in existence in parallel with Bad English, with the other guys that had been in Journey? Was that kind of around the same time?
Well, by circumstance, yes. In other words, Journey was not active at all in that time period. and Bad English. There you go. A great band. There might be other circumstances having to do with the personalities, but that, I love that music. Mm-hmm. I love that music.
Well, Hugh did the album covers for Bad English as well.
Well, see, there you go.
I was in the studio. Then they were actually going to call themselves Volte Wolf, which I thought sounded a little Third Reich, you know, for that band.
A little Third Reich.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
it just sounded and Trudy Green was managing them, and we were all in the studio discussing it. And I was kind of, it's not my place to resist. You know, if a band has an identity, you don't say that. That name sucks, but I kind of said that. And in that evening, they were playing pool or billiards behind us while we were talking. And somebody shouted, oh, man, that's some Bad English, which is instead of spin on the ball on a pool table.
Right.
And so when I heard that, I thought, there you go. That's your name. So
then you get the kudos then, right?
Yeah, you should get a cut.
Hugh goes
to
the mailbox every day since 1991. Still hasn't seen a damn.
He's been waiting. Where is it?
Yeah, it's in the mail, pal.
It's in the mail. It's on its way. Uh-huh. So I have a favor to ask. So one time I was backstage at a show, what, a Journey show or something. I don't remember where it was, but you came in the dressing room and my back was to you, but you started doing a spot on impersonation of Tom Shane.
Of the Diamond Center. We get our diamonds from Antwerp, Belgium. Now, why would he say Belgium? There's only one Antwerp. It's like London, England. Well, there's a London, Texas, but nobody goes there. Antwerp, Belgium. We select only the best.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Very good.
I've got some more colorful renditions. I will spare every.
I thought that was an Indiana thing that I didn't know that those were like, all over the country. The Shane commercials.
Was probably from Chicago, pal.
You think?
So, Chicago, Tom, Shane. Yeah.
Fantastic. Did you guys think that the Separate Ways video was a good idea at the time?
Well, our manager did, and we were sort of not entirely, but close to the forefront of music videos. And I think he cut a good deal.
It's a classic. You can't argue. It's so great.
Who are those guys? I think it's called Shredders or Shredding. Mm-hmm. I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, of course, we have that. Those videos to live down, but it got mileage too, you know.
Oh, and it still does. It's still one of those you watch it, you can't look away. It's great.
Yeah, we had a good deal on that. Harvey,
at least it wasn't like that Billy Squire one with the little shorts that he had on.
No, they're just that scene when you guys turn your heads and you're singing. I mean, those things are killer.
Never mind.
So one question about San Francisco. So we've talked to Bill Gibson from Huey Lewis. We talked to Fee Waybill from the Tubes. We talked to Corey and David from Pablo Cruz. But everybody that's from San Francisco, it seems like they always tell us just how great the community of musicians was. And obviously you've alluded to some of that over the years. But it seems like compared to a lot of other major markets that it's a really supportive community of each other. Is that something that you experienced similar to them and still do, obviously?
The operative word is freedom. And there was so much freedom to play what you wanted. And from a commercial end, the music industry saw that as something that they could promote. So the industry was much more open-minded. But there was just a lot of freedom to express, and you got, you know, in the San Francisco scene, so many different kinds of music that was really good. And there was some real crap as well, just like there is now, right? But the freedom to have the opportunity to get up and play, and if you built an audience, you could do well. Frumious Bandersnatch is a good example. We were credited with being a solid second line act, which means you could either open for or be in the middle slot for any headliner that came into San Francisco. So we were on a par with, Joy of Cooking. Santana Blues Band was the second line act at that time in the 67, 68. Of course, they broke wide open. But
did you ever play with Moby Grape? I did a record for Moby Grape.
I was never on a bill because I really liked Moby Grape.
Everybody we've talked to from San Francisco that saw them said they were the greatest band.
And what happened? Hey, well, you know, some of the members are gone. I think Skip Spence.
His son's in the band, Omar, and he's...
One guy I did keep up with because he was down in an area where my family has been over the years, down in the Santa Cruz Mountains, Jerry Miller.
Jerry Miller, yeah.
Caught a few things he was doing in later years. Otherwise, Moby Grape, what a fine band that just up and disappeared.
Jerry still lives in Tacoma. He plays two or three nights a week and teaches there. Don Stevenson lives in Toronto. I produced a record for him.
That's good.
They got great reviews in Mojo magazine a few years ago. And he's just put out a new record. So, and Peter Lewis has new stuff out. So they're all doing stuff. We're trying to organize it to maybe try to go play sometime while everybody's still breathing.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing about the scene and the freedom is not only if you could move an audience, even if they've never heard of you, that would help, you know. But Family Dog and Bill Graham, they would really mix up the order, the kind of different bands that they would put up there. And that allowed an audience that came to hear one band to hear something they never heard before. I remember in 65, we went to, I think it was the Avalon Ballroom, with my first rock band. We wanted to see the Young Rascals. Okay. We did at their very peak. I mean, and Dino, he'd be playing along and be throwing his sticks up behind the curtain 50 feet, not even looking. He would just grab it out of the air. And the band was amazing. But what we were not prepared for was the opening act. It was the Charles Lloyd Quintet. Okay. Avant-garde jazz, I knew, and it's music that I wasn't unfamiliar with given my varied background, but it was completely a different scene for the audience that was there to see the Young Rascals. He happened to have featured that night Keith Jarrett on a and me, Jarrett had been sampling the culture to a certain extent so that during his solo, he crawled inside of the piano and started plucking strings.
That was some good acid, wasn't it? That was Owsley.
We're just in high school and we're sitting on the floor. And we're going, whoa, what's that guy doing?
Did you see Keith Jarrett play anytime thereafter?
I must admit that I haven't, and I really love his music, especially there was this era in which he was doing solo piano, and it was Americana folk based on, you know, folk feel and folk chords and arrangements, and I thought that was just beautiful. It wasn't about chops, it was about...
Well, it was about chops, too. guy's got three hands.
There you go.
Yeah. And what I love about him, of course, is that he comes out on stage as empty-headed as possible and just begins with silence and lets it...
Except that one night he didn't.
It must have been the punch, or maybe it was in the arm.
It was feeling pretty good.
But it was you guys.
Electric Kool-Aid acid test. Come on now.
I like what you're saying about venues being eclectic enough to mix it up. There was a place in Toronto called the Rainbow Room. And I went late to see the Flying Burrito Brothers, which was great. But then opening for them was the very outside band from England called Family. Have you ever seen Family? My God.
I remember these Family.
Guys, yeah. So these guys were so...
Remember that band?
Opposite in terms of style, but there they were both on stage. And what an entertaining evening it was.
Yeah. Big surprise for you, right?
Yeah. All through the lens of a very good lysergic acid that evening, yeah.
Oh.
Huh. Yeah.
The lower slopes.
So that's what happened to Hugh. Now I know. Okay. All righty.
There's a pot calling the kettle black.
Man, that's how Howard Kalin talks. Wow, man. I met him walking down the street in St. Louis one time and found out. Oh, I said, he goes, yeah, we're playing over here, man. We're playing at this club across the street. What time do you get done? We're finished at 10, man. I said, oh, man, that's when we finish. I go, man, that's a drag because I won't be able to see you guys. No, man, that's not a drag. You're working. We're working. It's cool, man. And he was right, but it was that hippy-dippy weather, man. It was so fantastic. Loved it.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Ross. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. We should do this again.
Yeah, man. Best. I can't wait to hear all the other stuff. What a cool project. So just quickly, can you tell us who everyone that's involved, all the different players that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Our four guitarists. We have Vernon Black, better known as Vernon Ice Black, who's played with everybody, Mariah and all kinds of folks. He appears on Incident and Nishibor, Singer of Blue, and Low Rider. Okay. There are six songs with drums, and there's six drummers. Prairie Prince, Steve Smith, Walter Reyes, Greg Arrico, Celso Alberti, who appears on the Brazilian type song Windmill. He's a local Brazilian drummer. And Paul Spina, probably the least known. Paul is local to Sonoma County, and he appears on Incident and Nishibor and Singer Blue. Four guitarists. There's George Tickner on one song, God Rest His Soul. There's, I mentioned Vernon Black, Miles Shawn on one song, and I'm playing guitars on the fourth song. Additional players, Les Stroud, better known as Survivor Man, who plays a mean harmonica on Lowrider. Mark Russo appears on at least four songs on saxophone. Mark of the Yellow Jackets and the Dubais. Let's see, Josh Ramos, who is a fine local guitarist, is on vocals for Lowrider.
Cool.
Everybody thinks it's me. It could be me. I can do that voice, but I would have to, if I wanted to predictably record that voice, I would have to stay up all night on tequila and cigarettes, which I don't do anymore. Josh has got that voice 24 hours a day. Let's see, who else am I forgetting? Well, Eric Levy is on all of the pieces in one form or the other. That's about it. That's a long list of people.
Sure is.
How many vocal tracks on the album?
Well, one vocal track by Josh on Lowrider.
Okay. Yeah. Mm. And will you be touring? How are you going
to? Sooner or later, I'm going to get around to performing, but everyone recovering from the lockdown and the economy, and everybody's hard pressed, the musicians are busy out doing as much as they can. I am just now in the last year getting back into record mode because there's a lot more material that comes from back then, but there's a lot of new material as well. So that's what I've been focusing on. There's no plans for performance. I'm hoping that when I do, that I have a core band, if not a small orchestra, that can cover the bases. And
you got a lot of styles.
Given the variety of music on the album, if I wanted to cover it, I need, a couple of
17.
Yeah. You need some people, yeah.
But what is probably more immediately realistic would be some streaming from the sandbox, my studio living room. That could probably happen sooner, but I would like to perform. It's just I'm in record mode. I'm having fun for the first time, in my life, writing, arranging, orchestrating, and recording music. Which is, I waited a long time, but better late than never, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, man.
Absolutely. Congratulations on the new record and all the great songs, videos, etc. Really.
Thank you, Andy. And all of the above appears the middle of April. And Wild Kingdom is the second single. Windmill will come out within a month. All right, you guys. All right, man. I got to go.
Thank you. Take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.